connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for web.
Computer today.
Computer.
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 NetSurfer Pro.
Hello and welcome to NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web. I'm your host, Matthew Marissa.
And of course, as always, is your co-host, Galen.
And we were going to have a very special guest, but we were unable to book her, sadly, so we have the next best thing. Instead of whoever we were going to first book, please welcome, for the first time on the podcast, the voice from our intro, Harry.
My name is actually Brian, you unprepared hacks.
Welcome to the show, Harry. You know, I'm surprised to hear you say things that aren't just NetSurfer Pro, honestly. For a long time, I assumed that was all you could say, but, you know, that's maybe I just need to reflect on myself.
If I were you, I would avoid any reflections.
Wow, really cutting in with those words. Listen, so while you're here, so how'd you get started in voice acting?
I was literally made for voice acting.
Oh, okay, okay.
Okay.
Have you ever done singing?
I'm beginning to think you only booked me as a replacement for someone else.
Ah, too bad.
Yeah, that's very unfortunate about your grandma. But, you know, I think you should still give it a shot sometime.
Shot in the face, maybe.
Oh, okay, okay.
Okay.
That's incendiary. You know what? You've done your work for your today. Your paycheck will be in the mail Thursday. And you know what? Let's get on with the rest of the show.
Yeah.
So, super excited to do this topic today.
Yes.
This is something that we should have done like a million years ago. This is like super pertinent to the internet.
It's super pertinent to the internet. It's super pertinent to 1.5 people on this program.
True. Unless my dog Bonnie has any history with this. I don't know. But here's something you need to know about me. I was a huge weeb when I was a kid.
What? No way. That doesn't sound like us on this program at all.
I know. Luckily, the time I was a kid was when this topic for today started to really become big, so I have sort of real-time experience with it. I have like a first-hand account. You know, I'm like those writings on the walls in Pompeii. I was there for that shit.
Yeah.
Which is to say, if I close my eyes, it feels like nothing changed at all.
Technically, if you close your eyes in a lot of situations, you can be like, man, this is just like when I close my eyes in every other situation. Yeah. My history with this is a little bit less, about 50% less, in fact, to tie in with the numbers. That's a little long time number joke for fans of the previous 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Which that itself is a long time joke for the long time fans.
But I was always more of a casual fan of this particular topic. I did not know a lot of the deeper lore. I only sort of knew, I have a very like American Western perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I do too, in the sense that I am from America, which is in the West.
And you are from America and from a Western.
Yeah, I famously have like a lasso around my waist and I have a revolver. Is that what they use?
Yeah.
I have
a
horse.
You have a 10.5 gallon hat, which it's very hard to find those in, you know, that particular size.
I have a 10.5 gallon hat. Rode in on my horse last week. Her name's Friday. Stayed there for 3 nights, left on Friday.
the date or the horse?
Now, how is that possible?
Well, you see, there was only one calendar in the entire town, and it was stuck on Friday.
The batteries were dead, but they didn't have batteries. They didn't have any more batteries in the Old West.
Yeah.
They couldn't get new batteries. Okay, we're going so off topic. So I really like this because we're like slowly circling the drain of talking about everything within the Kumikyoku series of medleys. Even though this one wasn't in the first Kumikyoku no Nikunikudoka, we're slowly, like, we're gonna have like a supercut of everything in the medleys.
Yes.
And we are going to cover it all.
Yes.
Except for maybe like 3 things, which I'll leave to the audience to argue over what those might be and theorize. So we're talking about Vocaloids.
Yes, Vocaloids.
Now, what the fuck is a Vocaloid? Excuse my language.
Oh yeah, sorry. What the fuck is a Vocaloid?
So, you may have heard of one Vocaloid called Hatsune Miku.
I'm Hatsune Miku.
A beloved character of the internet. Songstress. Digital songstress.
Creator of
Minecraft.
Yeah, of Minecraft and Harry Potter.
Yeah, there's a bit of ethical differences between Hatsune Miku-ing Harry Potter versus Minecraft, but we won't get into that.
Yeah, true.
But she, it's interesting because I think her as a character is more well-known than what she is as, like, a product. That's right, she's selling herself.
Oh, no!
But not selling herself short.
It's good. I can give
you lessons how to ruin your podcast. It's a little less than Jake joke for the long time Jakes.
for the long Jake fans.
So, Vocaloids are interesting. This is a big part of sort of internet culture. Hatsune Miku herself has become sort of a uber character, the way that Sans and Shrek have. A character that's more defined by being used on the internet as like a character, like a symbol in like memes and references, and has sort of escaped the confines of her original context.
Yes. If you have ever seen like one of, I don't know, the little videos that's like, whoa, pipe bomb, or like, you know, Hatsune Miku eats a lemon, you can see what we mean, where it's like the sort of idea of Hatsune Miku is sort of more prevalent in, I would say, at the very least, again, American Western culture currently than Vocaloid.
Yeah. Or like with like Yonoid 2 Enter the Void.
Yes.
With all the Germa x Hatsune Miku fan art.
Happy birthday, Miku, from Jeremy.
Yeah. But so Vocaloids are interesting because they started before Hatsune Miku was a thing.
The Fact Corner.
So, Vocaloid is a brand of voice synthesizer software created by Yamaha. They do not create the characters, but they create the software. It's a digital audio workstation where, similarly to how you would compose music, you compose voices. The technical way it works is that it uses a piano roll interface where you place individual notes, adjust the length, the pitch, things like warble or timbre or attack and decay or legato, all those fun terms that I know what they are, and surely you know what they are as well.
Yes, you at home, please tweet at us on the Netzer for Pro Twitter what those terms all mean. This is a quiz.
Yeah. And so what you do is not only do you place notes, but each note is given part of the lyrics. You write the lyrics, you put the lyrics onto the note. Suddenly, not only do you have, like, you know, a MIDI file that says play a C sharp here, you have it tell a character to sing a sound in C sharp. So they have various, like, syllables and phonemes pre-recorded by people that are then brought in and combined into this big data bank of like individual mouth sounds. That is a voice synthesizer sound bank. Vocaloids, then the like character term, are terms for the individual sound banks that different companies license the ability to make and sell. Now, Miku wasn't even the first Vocaloid. It wasn't even a Japanese Vocaloid. The first two Vocaloids were Leon and Lola, soul singers made by a, I believe, a UK company, and it really didn't pick off from them. Which is, it's interesting, because, like, the technology was developed at a Spanish research institute, backed by a Japanese company, in this case Yamaha, and then the first one was English-speaking Vocaloids. So those were in 2004, and Leon and Lola were also soon followed by Miriam, a third English Vocaloid. That same year, Krypton Future Media would go on to release Mako and Kaito, who are the first female and male Japanese Vocaloids. Mako, nobody uses, like, was not very popular. Her design is the most normal of a lot of Vocaloids. like Leon and Lola didn't really have character designs. The box was just like a mouth of a person.
Yeah, the box designs, if there's one thing, well, there's multiple things you should look up from this episode, but look up the box designs for the first Vocaloids. They look like ads that would show up on Hustler emails.
Yeah, like they look like you would see them on like a billboard for a casino.
Yeah, yeah. It's very, I, it's I, not I think eye-catching. It's, yeah, it's, I think it's bad branding.
But that same year, so yeah, they released Mako and Kaito. They weren't very popular. Mako is a female voice. She looks like a normal person, all things considered. Kaito is a bit more anime in his design. He has blue hair and like a coat on.
And pronouns.
Yes. It's worth noting that all the Krypton future media Vocaloids had like a food item attached to them.
Ah.
Mako was associated, I believe, with either beer, sake, or soda. Something bottled.
Yeah.
And Kaito was related to ice cream.
What a wild little differential there of like, yeah. This is Kaito, he likes ice cream. This is Mako, she needs to get drunk to perform for you.
Yeah, so that was in 2004. The software wouldn't really catch on until Vocaloid 2, the second version of the Vocaloid program. And Krypton released the biggest thing ever.
Oh,
that's
my God.
When they released Hatsune Miku.
Holy shit.
Hatsune Miku, we need to talk about her character design, because I think a huge part of why it blew up was her character design.
Yes.
Like, the box, for one thing, just has the characters on it.
Yes.
But I think her design is better than Mako and Kaito's. For one, it's distinguishably anime. She has these long, like, twin tails on the side of her hair. Her hair is bright, like, cyan.
Yeah.
Like, that all is very identifiable. She has these, like, diamond-shaped hair ties that don't look like they are actually connected to her hair. They're, like, floating.
Yeah.
She has, like, a gray sort of dress on with detached sleeves. What I want to get to, though, is that, like, all this stuff is... Oh, and she has a necktie. Necktie is really good. This is, like, pretty modest in terms of character design. You're not going to find, like, the weird anime character designs here.
Yes.
But it's very iconic. She has a good silhouette, you know, to the point where if you made a, like, blacked-out silhouetted version of her, a lot of people could probably identify her. She has just, like, a notable hair color. They started leaning into this sort of digital-era character design, with things like very rectangular decals on her clothes, the diamond hair pieces. That's like, it pushes this image of this is a digital girl rather than a representation of a real life girl.
Yeah.
The way Mako was.
We are living in a material world and she is a digital girl.
Yeah. A rainbow girl. So after Miku,
a
though.
A rolling girl?
later after Miku, they would release Kagamine Rin and Len, who are twins. They are very good designs. Len is another male voice, and the last male voice that Krypton would do. They both have sort of higher pitched voices. Very good. And then the last one that Krypton would release is Luka, Megurine Luka, who is the first to have bilingual capabilities with both English and Japanese.
That makes sense. That makes sense that she would come after Hatsune Miku, but it is still interesting considering, like, from a modern perspective, how popular Hatsune Miku is.
Yeah, I want to mention a few others, though. So, Kryptons are by far the most popular. There have been, like, spin-off, like, manga. They've been referenced in a ton of things. Miku herself was huge in, like, anime. Like, there's a Lucky Star OVA where a character dresses up as Miku for Halloween.
She was on David Letterman.
She was on David Letterman.
That's not a joke.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's she's been big enough that they've done like Tupac-style hologram concerts multiple times.
Oh, man.
But a few other companies I want to mention. There's Internet Co., who made Gumi, a.k.a. Megpoid, and Gakupo, a.k.a. Gakupoid. Those two often appear with Krypton Media's group, to the point that for the longest time I thought they were made by the same people. Those two are also very popular with, I think Gumi might not be in a song on this album, but a ton of producers will pair Gumi with Miku specifically. There's a ton of other Vocaloids produced for different things, mainly English, but I do want to shout out Bruno, who is the first Spanish Vocaloid.
Based.
And there's, I think, three altogether made by the company that did that. With Vocaloid 3 later came a few other popular ones. I want to mention Ia, who has silver hair and has some good songs, and Yuzuki Yukari, who is great and recently gained a ton of popularity by the works of one musician. Currently, the software is on version 6, with new Vocaloids still being made, but Krypton, the one we were talking about, they've just continued to update and perfect their main characters. Except, I don't think they keep updating Mako. Nobody likes Mako.
Nobody gives a shit about Mako. Also, I missed my chance to make a We Don't Talk About Bruno reference. Yeah. And I just wanted to...
Sorry, we talked about Bruno.
Yeah, I just wanted to say you're all welcome to the listeners that I didn't make that joke then. I restrained myself.
There are a ton of other, like, English Vocaloids. There's a ton of other Japanese ones.
There's a lot of Chinese ones.
There's a lot of Chinese ones.
Some real fucking banger Chinese ones, too.
Yeah. With the Japanese ones, also I think interesting is Vi, who, instead of having a character, has a sword. Because the creators of the Vi Vocaloid didn't want them to have, like, a fixed gender. So swords are genderless in base.
Yep.
I guess.
My gender is sword.
There are some that are weird and have weird backstories, and I'm not going to talk about those. So, those are all what Vocaloids are. It's this really interesting combination of linguistics and music production and technology and, like, music theory from the technical side. From the character design side, it's very anime, but with sort of a focus on making widely appealing characters that sometimes lean into sort of performer archetypes. Like, Miku is still definitely based off the sort of Japanese idol.
Yep, yep.
And most of Krypton's other stuff as well. But you'll even have Vocaloids that are specifically, like, Enka singers and opera singers that are dressed for the occasion.
Yeah. A lot of the Chinese ones as well kind of, like, lean into, like, very different influences and stuff. I think there's, like, one that's very theatric.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The Chinese ones, they just look like Hoyo characters to me.
They really do. That is one thing, is, like, a lot of them, like, there's a number that have a good design. There's also a number that are exceedingly over-designed, and I'm just like, oh man, I got a 5-star on my gacha game.
Yeah. So that is the software, but you can't have a software and have it be popular without the people who actually use it.
The hardware.
Well, the humanware? The wetware?
The wetware? Oh no.
Wetware and why? So that in comes in the Vocaloid producer, the people who actually make the music. The Vocaloid producers, they make songs, they put Vocaloids in them, they release them. And I think there's a lot of really interesting things to talk about regarding this. There's a lot of well-known Vocaloid producers. I want to specifically shout out a few. I want to shout out Hachi, who has done, like, a ton of popular songs. They did, like, Matryoshka, Dune, Donut Hole. They've done a lot of really popular ones. Ryo, who is part of the group Supercell, who has done anime openings, but Ryo was, like, an early adopter of Hatsune Miku and has, like, a lot of early popular stuff with her.
Nice.
Neru does a lot of Len songs, which are usually pretty good, and has a fantastic music video for the song Law Evading Rock. Mikito P, who has the song Roki, which is a banger, but the image for it, like, the background image for it is so good. It also kind of has, like, a Mandela catalog reference?
Yeah, that one.
I swear to God, it looks like an intruder.
It looks like the fucking intruder. It really does.
Please, just all the background art's great. There's also, like, Scratchy is in there.
Yep.
It's just, like, a bedroom of things that look like real things. It's pretty great.
It's an iSpy catalog. It's an iSpy page.
Nayu Talion, who has, like, this whole concept universe about a character named Andromedeko, who came from the Andromeda Galaxy, and all their music videos are fantastic.
They're so good. They're two frames of animation, and they're lovely.
Yeah. And Jin, who we almost covered one of his albums today, but decided not to because we would have to watch an entire anime.
Yes.
Because there have been two anime, actually, based off Miku songs. Jin had a Makaku City Project, which became Makaku City Actors. The other one was Ryo, who did Black Rock Shooter. Here's a wild one. Black Rock Shooter, the anime, Linkin Park collaborated with them on the music.
Wait, what?
Yeah, one of the members of Linkin Park, Johan, made a remix of Black Rock Shooter for the anime, And also, just a fun fact, Michael Stipe of REM has gone on record to say Vocaloids are cool. I don't think he was referring to Miku. I'm pretty sure he was just referring to the concept of Vocaloids, but I like to think that Michael Stipe is really into Hatsune Miku.
Yeah. Michael Stipe and Hatsune Miku are friends, and I want to see that art. Want to see that fan art. twag us on x.com. With that cool Rem X Hatsune Miku.
I want to hear the Miku cover of It's the End of the World as We Know It.
Hell yeah.
She could do it.
She could do it.
Yeah.
She sung much harder songs.
Yeah. So this is another thing I want to talk about. So Miku and Vocaloids as a whole are interesting because they're not people. Sorry. But also that means they can do things people can't do. Here comes Fast Miku. Yeah. There is a really popular sort of trend of people making essentially just Miku out to be the rap god. Because being a digital voice, she doesn't need to take breaths. She doesn't need to breathe. And so she could just keep singing without stop. And you could even sing certain syllables faster than you really should be because, you know, you could speed them up digitally. So that leads to songs like The Disappearance of Hatsune Miku, which is just like rapid fire mouth movement. Like, you cannot sing to it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's
only Eminem could or Busta Rhymes, and they've been very quiet.
Yeah. Top 10 rappers Eminem is too afraid to diss. Yeah. Number one is Hatsune Miku.
Yeah. So that's really interesting. I think also there's just an interesting bit about the songwriting involved with Vocaloids, because a lot of producers will write from the perspective of the Vocaloid as the main character. Like, obviously, they'll, you know, have songs based around sort of themselves. But you see this a lot with, like, male producers who write songs that have, like, female first-person pronouns, using things like watashi or atashi instead of, like, boku or anything.
Yeah.
And like, I think that's just super interesting because sort of the characters for these characters, like, the you know, their personalities, their beliefs, their ideologies, the sort of character details of these Vocaloids aren't really set in stone. The Krypton media had kind of very little to actually do with it. And so a lot of it has been concocted by the fans and the producers. Like, I think the most you could say is that Miku is very hardworking and upbeat. That's like the official Krypton stance.
Yeah, that's...
She's nice, popular. She buys onions, leeks. That's
she,
it.
She likes vegetable juice.
Yep. That, I mean, that wasn't a Krypton official
song.
Oh,
yeah, sorry.
The only song Krypton, I think, really did for Miku was Miku Miku Nishite Ageru, because every Vocaloid has a sample song, and that's the one for Miku.
Understandable.
And that's just about like how excited she is to make music with
nice.
You.
Nice.
She's like, thanks for installing Hatsune Miku. But yeah, so like a lot of the character details were sort of implied or constructed by producers, and producers tend to write from the perspective of the character. I think you get a lot of sort of story songs this way, because Miku is a character. You can then write songs from the perspective of a character in a story.
Yeah.
Hachi did this a few times. There's the one of like demons and foxes coming out at night or something. I don't remember the name. It's very complicated. And there's like that led to this whole genre of like horror Vocaloid songs.
Is this do we need to address the like the Lorkaloid
briefly? Yeah. So here's the thing. So this all is just sort of in general, a lot of it about Japan, but now we need to get to the American side and the West as a whole, because there's a bit of a problem.
America is built upon the blood of innocent people. Oh wait, sorry, not that problem. Different problem.
All of this stuff was uploaded to Nico Nico Doga, which is a Japanese video sharing site very similar to YouTube. But it's in Japanese, so, you know, people in the West couldn't really use it. A lot of people would start uploading these or re-uploading these to YouTube. However, a ton of the people who did re-uploads of Vocaloid songs did not put the name of the artist in the title of the video or the description.
Yep.
Instead, they would just credit the Vocaloid. So instead of Matryoshka by Hachi, it was Matryoshka by Miku and Gumi.
Yeah.
which was pretty bad because, like, you're taking away recognition that these artists rightfully deserve by doing this. But it had an interesting side effect of, like, making the Vocaloid canon more prevalent. That, yeah, like, by acting as if these were all sort of made by the same person, it meant that people were much more involved in the scene of, like, oh, you have to listen to this song and this song and this song. When I was a kid, I listened to stuff off the album we're talking about today, and I listened to, like, stuff by Hachi and Rio and all that. But, like, I didn't realize how many actual artists were behind those. It all kind of blended together as if it was one conglomeration, which I think helped cement a lot of the Vocaloid's characteristics and just popularity. Because, like, you could just look up, like, Hatsune Miku songs and get all these Miku songs and then get an idea of Miku as, like, a figure.
It's an interesting, like, weird emergent outcome where, on one hand, it sucks. Undeniably, it sucks that, like, a big part of it getting popular was that these artists kind of lost the recognition, at the very least when it came to, like, crossing over to the Western world. Big asterisk over the Western world, by the way. We've been using the term, and we're going to continue using it, but blah, 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 the world isn't actually East and West, etc., etc. Anyway.
It's actually North and South.
True. It's clockwise and Widdershins, just a little Discworld reference for longtime fans. But, so, like, on one hand, undeniably, the fact that, like, a lot of artists did not get credited, even if it was done, you know, just, like, completely innocently, like, I don't understand Japanese, but I have screen recording software and it's 2007, let me upload this to YouTube. Like, that sucks. That is unfortunate. It's actually very relevant to the main topic we're going to be talking about as well. But at the same time, I would also say there's something interesting about, like, the effect it had. Like you said, the fact that I could go on YouTube on that period and type Miku song and get, like, a wide, wide, wide variety of different songs from a bunch of different creators all under Miku kind of, like, I wouldn't say helped make it popular, but, like, I think
it did.
Yeah, like, it helped cement them as, like, canon characters.
Mm-hmm.
It helped cement them as, you know, good songs, basically. Mm-hmm.
There was sort of a feeling that Vocaloid was its own genre, despite really just being different genres that were all using the same software. But, like, even now, like, if you play a lot of rhythm games, they'll have a separate Vocaloid section of the music, which is essentially saying this is a whole super genre.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing about the sort of Western side of the fan base is that the songs are in Japanese, people don't speak Japanese, so you would get people translating them. However, translating's fucking hard, especially Japanese to a romance language, because they're not the same. It's like languages that use, like, kanji or hiragana and romance languages, they have different ways of writing, different ways of speaking, different ways of constructing sentences. This is all going to sound like bad linguistics, but please bear with me. It's different and it's hard. And so, like, you know, translating directly is one thing. Usually you then have localizers who will read the translation and try to reconstruct it in a way that makes sense. Not oftentimes will this directly fit the, like, meter of the song, but at least it will work as, like, English sentences. But I feel like not a lot of translators did a great job at localizing. They just kind of ended at the literal translation. And sometimes this would lead to translations that are pretty significantly different from what would later come out as, like, official versions.
Yeah.
There's one song in particular on this album that is, like, really bad about this that I have a huge bone to pick, but also not only did this lead to, like, sort of different interpretations of songs based off different translations, it also led to a sort of developing theory culture, because you take songs that already have a lot of metaphor, translate them to a language that doesn't track quite right, making the lyrics more vague, and you end up with something kind of complicated and hard to parse if you're just reading the lyrics and listening to the thing separately. So that led to a lot of Western side worrying about, like, the real meaning of the song. And, I mean, I'm gonna say some stuff like that, but I'm trying to avoid this is the definite true answer. And it was also kind of bad because a lot of people were leaning towards, like, songs all having a tragic truth.
Yeah.
Some things definitely do. There's definitely people who would make songs with sort of tragic backgrounds to them. But I think a lot of people took it a little overboard. And again, I'll get to that with one of the later songs on this album.
The dark meaning behind Popipo.
Exactly. So like, yeah, is Popipo Soylent Green?
Yeah, no, it's not. It's vegetable juice. She does a spin with a leek. It's adorable. Shut up.
So, I really don't want to badmouth the current English Vocaloid scene, but there's a lot of people who make English Vocaloid stuff that lean so hard into that, and I kind of hate it. It's like, it's very, like mascot horror inspired, and that's just really not my jam.
So, okay, as somebody who is a famous mascot horror fan.
Apologist. Say it like it is.
Yeah, you're allowed. As somebody who is a mascot horror apologist, it's something where the first time I saw a song that was in that style, in the sort of, like, bending the ink machine, like, Living Tombstone sort of,
yeah, you know, it's very that, Living Tombstone,
yeah, in that purview, the first time I saw it I was like, yeah, all right, I fuck with this is pretty good. And then the second time I was like, oh, okay, so another one like this. And then the third time and the fourth time and the fifth time, and I was like, okay, look, lore isn't a story. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
that there are good stories out there. There are good stories in mascot horror. There are good stories in, like, you know, lore baity type stuff.
If you're gonna write a murder mystery, try to write a better murder mystery,
more or less.
A lot of them are written like murder mysteries, but it's just like the song doesn't mention that they're dead, but they're actually dead, and this is, they're dead.
There's a whole ass video to be made about, like, the intersection between, like, high lore bullshit and Tumblr sexy man bullshit and, like, you know, the, like, faux darkness of it all and the appealing to young people. And I'm not gonna make it on this podcast today in less than 5
well,
minutes.
Well, yeah, because we don't make videos. It's a fucking podcast. What do you think a podcast would have a video?
Check your YouTube feed. That's right. We're live right now.
Right now.
Oh, right now. No.
The camera's right behind me, isn't it? Then you turn around and it's just like, everybody.
I was about to say. Damn it.
Okay.
No, that's the last episode. Fuck.
So, other thing I want to just say is that a lot of people lean into Vocaloids being digital. And we'll get to that throughout this. But, like, Disappearance of Hatsune Miku, Rainbow Girl, even the first song, Miku Miku Nishitageru, is, like, about Miku being a program.
Yeah.
That is a pretty common sort of topic, and I think it's partially just because that's interesting to write about in the digital age.
Yes.
And, like, it's a cool subject. Disappearance is about deleting Miku and, like, the pain and turmoil that causes her.
It is arguably, like,
it's fucking wild.
It is arguably a, like, really early example of digital horror.
Sort of. Or at least just, like, it is a complete digital sci-fi story in song form.
Yeah.
It also fucking goes hard.
Yeah, it fucks.
I forgot to say this, but as far as all the, like, theory bait, lore bait stuff, fucking Stupendium solos all of you. I'm sorry.
You're not wrong.
Yo, that Stupendium Baldi's Basics song fucking goes hard. I'm not ashamed to say it. Okay, so finally we can talk about the actual goddamn topic. So first we need to talk about Wawaka.
Wawaka.
Wawaka, also known as Genji Tsutohi P. P being producer. Mikito P, Kurage P, producer. He was a hugely influential Vocaloid producer. Like, when I say hugely influential, I will go over how, but he was huge. He first released the song In the Gray Zone in 2009, and then went on to release hit after hit, many of which are on this album. This finally culminated in the album Unhappy Refrain, released in 2011. Afterwards, he would form the band Hitorie, which was formed with other, like, doujin artists. I think there was, like, some Toho cover artists there as well. Maybe another Vocaloid artist. He would do the lead vocals and guitar. And through Hitorie, he actually ended up doing covers of two of his Vocaloid songs with that band.
Nice.
One of which is on this album, another which is the last song he released. Sadly, in 2019, he passed away from heart failure.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
He
was mourned by many, with many, many Vocaloid producers and people in the industry paying their respects. And luckily, I think that's really nice. Hitorie still does make music. They even made an anime opening for something that I forgot. But, like, I think it's nice that they're still making music.
Yeah.
I think that's a good way of carrying on the torch. Wawaka has a super notable style. Here's a few sort of standouts. So first off, the drums are maxed. The drums are so high. The drums are mastered so high. He uses a crash cymbal like a hi-hat. Like, normally when you think of, like, drum set composition, you have, like, kick drum as the regular sort of beat, snare on the offbeats, maybe to make more of a complicated rhythm, and then hi-hat sort of fills in. It's like the weak cymbal that you do. That's like... Tss, tss, tss.
Yeah, the...
It fills space, essentially. He uses the crash cymbal as many times as a normal drummer would use a hi-hat.
Yeah.
Just comes in slamming, it's like... Psh, psh, psh. It's so interesting. It, like, peaks the microphone. I don't even know if it's a physical or digital drum set, so I don't know if it can peak. It's just mastered pretty high above all the other instruments as well. He uses rhythm piano a lot, in that, like, he'll have piano parts, but not often as the lead melody, or even, like, a counter melody. It's like, it plays chords in a rhythm. This is in a lot of the songs on this album as well. You have just, like, a constant piano chord drumming over and over again. He intentionally makes the lyrics sound more robotic. Like, there are songs from around this time period that weren't so, I don't know, cold or robotic. Like, Popipo is a pretty old song, but I think Miku's voice, other than being Vocaloid, it has a sort of presence to it, a sort of, like, reverberation and timbre that doesn't sound too computer.
Yeah.
But Wawaka uses, like, a lot of filters and things like reverb and I think phasers to, like, and maybe even, like, compressors to really make it sound like it's digital.
Which kind of, at the very least, with this album, really leads to really supports the theme, the thesis.
Yeah. His lyrics are usually very somber and melancholic, a lot of them dealing with heavy depression and themes of such. And what's really important about his style is that, so the songs were released as singles on Nico Nico Doga, and they always had a single image representing the song. These were always monochrome, black and white and gray, sort of abstract pieces representing the song. And I'll point out some of them that are important as we go on. But, like, the monochrome, black and white and gray style persisted all throughout his sort of Vocaloid career. And it's, you know, it continues on the cover of this album, which is all black and white and gray. It's the first song he made in the gray zone. It's super iconic, and modern sort of remakes and versions of these songs continue that symbology.
Yes.
Like, for example, in Project Diva, there's one of the songs on this album, or there's a few of them, and I think in all of them, Miku only wears black and white.
Yeah.
As opposed to her normal sort of cyan or other colors. Strictly monochrome. So the album is Unhappy Refrain, released in 2011. Bit of a fun story about this. So I bought this album a few years ago when we were moving houses, and I bought it on iTunes. Sometime last year, I was trying to listen to it, and I couldn't find it on my phone. For some reason, it just disappeared off iTunes. Only the song Rolling Girl is available for me to listen to on the album that I purchased on iTunes, which is pretty fucked up. I don't know, like, who owns the rights. I would assume Hitorie owns the rights to the album. But yeah, I can't listen to most of the songs that I paid for, so that's fun.
Yeah. If there was going to be one song left, and I know that it's not on this album, but Disappearance of Haruhi Suzumiya would... Haruhi Suzumiya? Fuck! I fucked up the joke!
That's also not a Wawaka song.
Damn it! I know it isn't, but it, you know, it would have been a good joke, but now you gotta throw me out and get a new
podcast. I have the DVD
host.
Copy of Disappearance of Haruhi Suzumiya and the book.
You also have the DVD copy of Bo 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 Bo.
Yep. I do, however, still have on iTunes my copy of the album Mainichi Ga Everyday from the J-Rock Dojin group Tetsuneko, aka Team Nekokan.
Nice.
Famous for I Can't Defeat Airman.
Based.
So, the album starts off with Unhappy Refrain, the song. The image for this is like two nested monochrome hearts, grayscale, I guess. Two nested hearts with like a shard sticking into the inner one. Pretty cool. This song is important because it is a response largely to the feeling that Wawaka himself was not represented or given enough credit, and Miku was taking too much credit.
Yes.
Essentially, it's written like a deal with the devil, where Miku has saved him from a life of monotony, made him popular, whereas his original sort of music work wasn't really popular or getting out there. But through that, he feels this sort of sense of unease. Repeatedly, this is told through the point of view of Miku herself. She's saying, like, is that right? That's okay, that's okay. Like, trying to console him or convince him that it's fine that she's the one getting popular because at least somebody's listening to the music.
Yeah.
It also references another song on the album, one that got really popular, and that's the second song on the album.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is that I believe there's a couple of cross-references in the album based on the mm-hmm. translations I was reading.
Yeah.
Which is, one, I always love that. Two, though, it's also really interesting because I believe, again, this is based off of my own Googling, I believe Unhappy Refrain was, for a very long time, the last song that he produced as Wawaka.
Yes. The last song he produced as Wawaka after Unhappy Refrain was Unknown Mother Goose, which was about sort of the same topic. In that case, it was that he was like this unknown creator who had birthed these songs. And
yeah,
but yeah, you could tell that even in Japan there was sort of these issues of crediting the producer over the Vocaloid.
Yeah,
and this has been much better in recent years. I think a lot of modern day producers like Mikito P or Kurage P are known as their artist first, in the Vocaloid second.
Yeah, I think that like modern internet and modern culture has placed a lot higher stakes on, you know, actually crediting the real people behind a project.
Mm-hmm.
And so like this is thankfully like less of a problem today, and like there's more people who get direct recognition for it. But Unhappy Refrain is also a fucking banger, and it's a fucking banger that I think needs to exist.
Yeah.
As kind of like this big, you know, decompression of just like, I'm making all these cool songs and nobody knows my name.
Yeah, I love the intro with like the hardest drum hits of all time.
Yes.
Combined with like the harsh distortion guitar. It is an explosion, which fits with the first line about like a shotgun in a Telecaster.
Yeah.
Wild, great stuff. If you listen to this, you will hear what I mean about the drums being maximalized. It's just all surrounding, all encompassing. Next song, Rolling Girl. This is one of the most popular ones from Wawaka and the album as a whole. The bit was that in Unhappy Refrain, like the second pre-chorus is about like something something rolling in something something rolling. It says rolling twice in the pre-chorus, and
it's actually, hang on, I'm looking at the lyrics here. It says keep rolling, 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 rolling.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah. Christina Aguilera better switch me chairs so I can sit next to Hatsune Miku and Fred Durst.
And you're arguing over which one was rolling first.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Rolling Girl is pretty straightforward. It's a girl who has failed a lot in the past, probably has some depression, but she is able to keep rolling and push through all that, you know, going through it one more time, one more time.
Yeah, Rolling Girl, a little exercise. If you, like me, have listened to these songs a lot, but have not actually really looked up the lyrics, look up, like, oh gosh, I think it's the fandom. There's like a translation wiki that, like, again, we did just say, like, you know, translations are kind of their own
The translation wikis nowadays use official translations when available.
Right.
And this one has an official translation because it is in Project Diva.
Yes. And, like, my God, some of these are fucking jams in both the, like, literally sounds good sense and also just, like, real powerful lyrics, real good. Like, the Rolling Girl one is kind of just like a, well, gotta pick myself up and keep moving on, I suppose, jam. And it's it fucks. It's awesome.
So these songs don't really have official music videos prior to the Project Diva versions, but it's very popular at the time and still today for animators online to make music videos for Vocaloid songs. I think nowadays, oftentimes, they will just get hired by artists to make songs, which is how you get things like the Telecaster B-Boy, which is based in gender.
Yep.
And that's also where, like, Wabuku and Sakiyama and the other artists we talked about in the Zutomayo episode.
Yes.
A lot of them started as Vocaloid MV creators. But one of the popular ones for Rolling Girl just has, like, an image of Miku kind of curled up, just rotating.
Yeah.
It's absolutely phenomenal.
It is so good.
Yeah.
It is iconic. It is really funny. But, like, it's also, like, just kind of a perfect little, like, just snapshot, basically.
Yeah. This one also is, like, the only one to have an actual melody done by the piano, which is really surprising.
Yeah.
It has a nice piano at the start. It continues it through the drums. The drums are, like, almost drum and bassy, but they're a bit more busy than drum and bass. But they feel drum and bass inspired. Next is Tsumiki no Ningyo, which is called, like, Doll of Building Blocks, I believe is what it translates to.
Correct. That's right. You've been secretly playing this entire time a game because I have the Vocaloid fandom wiki up.
Oh, that's translation Wang.
That's English Wang.
This one I kind of don't like because it's very short. It feels like it's kind of an amalgamation of other sort of themes and riffs from other songs. It's still fine, though. A lot of toy metaphors in this one. There's, like, a baby doll, building blocks, a toy soldier. You know, the title is literally Doll and Building Blocks. But also, there is a lot of glass references with, like, the first line talking about an hourglass running out of sand. There's, like, glass slippers, shattering colored glass. My interpretation of the lyrics is that it's sort of a person who is pretty but infantilized. Which is unfortunately very common for women.
Yep, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, they're made to feel like a baby doll who can't escape this current situation. They try to leave, but they get caught in the door or what have you. They get degraded without really doing anything wrong. And ultimately, like, they are made to feel like they're made of glass and could shatter easily. But the pressure they're under and sort of the abuse makes them shatter nonetheless. One bit I like is that there is a lyric, which is Warachatta, which just translates to it broke, or and then they broke, or and then it broke. It happens twice in the song. The first time, the music stops momentarily, and then it continues.
Yeah.
But there's a moment where everything is quiet. The second time, abruptly ends the song. Like, it's like the second or first measure. Or no, it's like the fifth or sixth measure of a phrase. So it feels like it shouldn't stop there.
Yeah.
It just abruptly ends
it.
It
broke. Suddenly broke.
Yeah. Pretty wild sort of composition there.
Yeah.
It's really evocative as like the entire thing is building up to this sort of shattering. And then there it goes. Next is Boku no Saino.
My talent.
I love this one.
Yeah, this is a fucking banger.
This has the phaser effect going on the vocals. In, like, the pre-chorus, everything sort of gets drowned out as if you're underwater, including the vocals. It's very cool. This is one of the most robotic ones on the album. I just like the sort of composition of this one, too. I don't know. It's like, I think, like, the verses have this nice sort of break going on in between them. And it builds up to the chorus where the drums kick back in again. Though I think there's a bit more, like, normal cymbal going on, which makes it nice. Yeah, it's a fun one. The title seems to be about how, like, there's, again, it's a relationship, not doing too hot. They feel like their singing is not able to really patch things up. That, like, despite their talent, it's not really helping. There's the sense of distance growing.
Yeah.
They're just together, but the love is fading, unable to find a reason why they're sticking around beyond just sort of appearances. Next one, though, Nichijou to Chikyu no Gakubuchi. I fucking love this one. One of the most underrated songs on the album.
I believe this is one of the ones that I, like, heard and immediately added to, like, my favorites.
Yeah.
Because I was just like, holy shit. I missed out on so much.
I know, right?
Like, so I have heard of like, three of these songs, and oh my god.
Yeah. this one's great. It's a banger. This is one of the ones that Hitorie did a version of themselves.
Nice.
And that version's phenomenal as well. It's just great. So this is the first instance of Fast Miku, really. It'll be more pronounced later. But the verses of this song are kind of monotone, which instead of feeling like robotic monotone, it's more rhythmic. Like it kind of matches the drum rhythm, which has not really the same sort of constant snaring. The drum beat's like a little complex in this in a way that I can't think of a way to compare it to. But it has this sort of not quite syncopated, not quite polyrhythm, but like it has a really interesting snare beat going on. And it's like kind of light on the cymbals, so the snare really stands out.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean, but what the fuck would be the term for that?
I also, just like in the verses, there's a lot of guitar, not feedback, but it's like when it very briefly like goes, it's like a Tom Morello thing almost.
Yeah.
like tweaking the guitar, I guess.
Yeah.
It's pretty great. This only has one verse and then it has like three choruses. The lyrics, though, it's sort of about fame in a way, but in a tragic way. Again, there's a lot of melancholy and tragedy on this, but in this case, it's that, like, it talks about, like, crushing the spotlight, but the choruses end with, like, how does it feel to be so up high? And there's some part in the lyric that also talks about, like, this isn't the top, this is the edge of a sphere. Essentially, it feels like this is the life of being, you know, a popular, liked artist or musician, but it's not that different from before, you just have more eyes on you.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't an escape, it's just the edge of still, you know, having the same sort of monotony. You still have sort of monotonous, tedious tasks that you're doing, it's just under a different context with more eyes. Something also mentions, like, wanting to descend gracefully, which I think is sort of like wanting to escape the spotlight in a way that does not ruin you.
That feels like that pairs kind of well with the cover art of the girl falling.
Yeah. It also kind of refers to a later song, one of the other singles off this album, which we'll get to much later. Yeah, this song is fantastic. People have made like duet versions which edit the Miku and the Hitorie versions together, and those are great.
Nice.
Yeah, it's good stuff. This one's really fun. Next is Tenohira, which is a very like slow and calm one almost. It's the slowest on the album, I would say. It's a pretty straightforward song about sort of loss and death, looking to the sky to sort of, you know, hope that they're out there and okay. Very heavenly in that regard. I don't have a lot to say about it other than it's slow and has like more melodic piano here, but the piano is very drawn out. I don't know. Like, this one's just nice. It's a good break.
Yeah.
I think the pacing on the album is really good because sometimes you do get these slower paced songs. This one especially is like almost upbeat. The lyrics are about, you know, someone reminiscing about their dead loved one, but it's almost positive in that regard, or like forward facing.
It's, you know, acknowledge the good times while looking to the future, kind of.
Yeah. Next is Tosenbo, which is another one I love.
Yep.
This is one of the faster ones. So, interesting bit one. So, Tosenbo means something like, I won't let you through, or you won't pass. From my research, it's something that, like, a bully would say when they block your path.
Okay.
This song has a lot of childish lyrics, a lot of references to, like, games and stuff. And, according to one, like, person on the internet, it's also a pun on the word for child as well. And Tosenyu, I think, was like a song that kids sing at stopwalks.
Okay.
About like, you know, I will pass or let me pass.
Yeah.
Sort of being like, you know, come on, let the light turn green so I can walk. But this is the opposite. This one, instead, it feels like someone who is like putting on a front for their feelings, trying to hide them, succeeds and faces backlash that, like, now that they have put up this front so consistently of being unaffected and fine, they can't not be fine because it's abnormal.
Yeah.
People expect them to be okay. It's a tragic sort of consequence.
Self-fulfilling prophecy, kind of.
Yeah. It's interesting because quite a few of the songs on this album are terminally climactic. If you're a fan of we did a lore explanation for Coheed and Cambria, and I talked about that term on that.
Yes.
But if you're unaware, it's essentially most songs put the climax in the chorus or the bridge. Terminally climactic songs specifically have an outro or something special about a song that is the climax, and it's at the end.
Yeah.
So in this case, the final chorus and the final chorus part, like the final syllable of the final chorus is stretched out longer with harder drum beats during that. And then it ends with a final, "I will not let you break through," where the thing ends. Similarly to the Warachata from, what's it called? Tsumiki no Ningyo.
Now, is there a song in here where Hatsune Miku needs man?
No, but there is one where she mans her own jackhammer.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Next song is Line Art, which is fucking wild. I love Line Art. I kind of tend to skip it, but it's great. Line Art is, it's not just an explosion, it's like a fire. It's like the incineration in the sun. It is, from the start, like, drum roll, going absolutely hard on the drums, full-on Animal from the Muppets. Then Miku comes in, like, screaming, with the guitar trying to catch up, almost, playing, like, the same notes or in harmony, but just Miku is, like, so overpowering. It only has a few actual lyrics, because all the lyrics are stretched out. She'll say, like, one word, and it'll take five measures to do so. The lyrics give sort of an almost magical feeling to them. Like, it talks about, like, wanting to connect lines to lines and paint yourself the same color and then fly off into the sky.
Okay.
So the line art in this case is sort of, instead of two separate images of people, it's one image of two people that is then painted. There's an artistic process of drawing this. However, I think this is also connected to Tenohira, because, like, they're looking at the sky, the person's painted the color of the sky is literally a lyric, and they want to fly off to the sky. This is, they want to be with their dead lover in the sky.
Yeah.
This is a follow-up to that, sort of. That's my reading on it. But it's really interesting. It also just, like, it breaks from the high energy slammage, and then it has just like a piano solo with Miku singing. I think that's when she talks about like connecting lines to lines, and then it goes back to the absolute wacky turbo blast mode. Yeah. For the final few lines. It's so much. I would love to hear a live version of this, but I don't know if it's actually possible to do live. I feel like you would need like three drum sets to do this.
Yeah, you need the Metallica like double drum kick pedal.
Yeah.
But for all of the different drum kicks.
Yeah. Also, I just think like this shows how another thing that Vocaloids can do that humans aren't as good at is having the biggest possible range ever.
Yes. Like, God, yes.
There is literally a song called like Hatsune Miku Sings the Upper Register, which is just about how high Miku's voice can go as a digital Vocaloid. It's kind of a meme in rhythm games.
That's amazing.
But even here, like, her voice goes so high that it feels like it's going to break a wine glass. It's great. Next one is the big one.
Oh, shit.
Properly romanized and translated as Uraomote Lovers.
Oh, shit, I'm back in it!
Otherwise known as Two-Faced Lovers. Heads, I sing Hatsune Miku, Batman. Tails, you die. Heads, you got lucky this time. Yeah. Two-Face. That's just it just has heads on. You know it just has heads on the... Shut up, Batman. I know it just has heads on the side. Why do you think I do this? Yeah. It's my thing.
Two-Face, if you just wanted me to listen to you sing Hatsune Miku, you didn't really need to capture me and do the whole thing. Like, there's actual people outside. Batman, shut up and listen to me sing Uraomote Lovers.
Yeah, so this is the Fast Miku.
Yep.
This is, like, one of the most notable Fast Miku songs. Full-on rap god. I love the mashup that, I believe, I don't remember what she goes by now, but... of
the artist formerly known as
Truongasm.
Yeah, I believe it's Mom.
It's just Mom.
It's just Mom now.
The artist and streamer known as Mom. the mashup of this and fucking Let's Go by Busta Rhymes.
Yeah. It's slightly ruined not
Let's
the
Go.
Song.
It's Hypnotized by Busta Rhymes with a verse from Let's Go, but it's Busta Rhymes' verse from Let's Go.
Yeah, the good verse from Let's Go.
I don't know, the Travis Barker one's pretty
actually
good.
Yeah, it is. But yeah, no, so Uramonte Lovers is fucking excellent, has a Project Diva version that is probably slightly surpassed the original version, at least the original, definitely surpassed the original, like, music video.
This one's interesting because it has, like, a synth piano, like a keyboard, and the rhythm piano going on at the same time.
Yes. I also, like, I like how tying in with the, you know, like, intentionally sounding a little more robotic. There are parts where Miku duets with herself.
And that matches the lyrics, actually.
Yes.
So, you want to talk about sex?
Yeah!
This song is about sex. The song is about sex. The song is about sex. Song is about sex. There's the music video that's popular for this one is just all innuendos. There's literally a peeled banana. So, Two-Face Lovers in the song title, to me, is more about the singer herself. She splits into two sides, the, like, logical, reason-based side, and the one purely driven by the primal sexual desire. The reasoning side is unhappy with the relationship she's in, but that primal side just wants sex.
Yep.
And the sex feels good, and so she does sex. It's debatable how complicit the partner is or how abusive the partner is. The second chorus seems to have references to sort of emotional manipulation, like threatening to leave someone just to get them to have sex with you.
Yeah.
It's unclear if this is by Miku or the singer or by the singer's partner. Probably the latter, but it could just be both. It's hard to say. It could be like a codependent relationship, you know?
Yeah.
Here's where we get to the complicated bullshit. So, the old English translation, when it was first re-uploaded to YouTube, in the second line, in the second line in the chorus, it said, expand your midriff, while the official translation has that line as, breathe from your diaphragm. I would probably translate to something like breathe in and breathe out from the waist or something to fit the meter, but that's neither here nor there. Combined with the line, sayonara baby, in the verses, it made a ton of people think this was about, like, a miscarriage or an abortion.
Yeah.
Like, using pregnancy to rope somebody into staying in a relationship.
Yeah.
But there's really not anything to indicate pregnancy in the official translation. The line's been clarified to be breathing heavily.
Yeah.
Rather than that. And sayonara baby could just be a fun, silly way of saying goodbye, you know? Like, sayonara baby.
Sayonara baby.
Or it could be, like, her losing her reasoning side when it gets down to the wire.
Yeah.
You know, saying goodbye to logic. But, like, it's sort of a problem because, like, nowadays, so many people think this is strictly about pregnancy, to the point where I saw, like from this year, I was looking up the music video for this, and I saw some, like, React YouTuber reacting to it, and somebody in the chat was like, this is about a dead baby, this is about a miscarriage, and I'm just like,
no, it isn't.
Like, you could get that from the original translation, but since then, the official translation has come out, and it doesn't really indicate that. So, if you're ever wondering how, like, different translations can lead to a different experience with a song, that's a really good example.
Yeah.
I think, like, the abusive relationship side is definitely present either way in both translations, and that makes sense because that's sort of part of the song.
Yeah.
But, like, the pregnancy part, people latched onto hard, and so much of the perspective from the English speaking side of the fan base was about that in particular.
Yeah.
That, and that's part of where, like, the theory culture comes in.
Yeah, that feels more kind of like an early, you know, the early examples of, like, don't you know this thing's actually
fucked
up? Yeah,
it's the Rugrats theory.
Yeah, the Rugrats theory.
If you want to make it seem darker than it is, throw in a miscarriage.
Yep.
It sucks, but, like, fucking, if Tim Buckley can do it.
Could Tim Buckley do it? That's a very good question that we should answer.
If he could.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
I'm not saying it works, so, you know, you can extrapolate my thoughts. Yeah.
Oh, man.
It's that's sort of a bone I have to pick. It's just sort of, there's a lot of stuff like that. We'll get to a similar song
later. Much like
the
bone that was picked in the song.
Hey, that's a sex joke.
It's a sex joke.
Yo, let's talk about, it's like Cumtown on this podcast. Yeah. We could be the new Cumtown. Cum City.
Yeah. I think it's more of like a cum metropolitan.
Cumtropolis. Okay, new song. In the Gray Zone. It was the first song in the thing. It's the...
Hey!
This
the
one's
Gray Zone.
Great.
It's great?
Yeah. This one has a really cool guitar riff going through it that's led in harmony by a wobbly sort of synth. This one's interesting because in my reading, I feel like this song is from the perspective of Waka himself. This is the most depression-centered one. Sort of very clearly being about things losing interest and losing color and just sort of disappearing into nothingness.
Yeah.
Straight up just saying, I hate you now. This is really interesting though, because it builds up to like building a fantasy, and then like there's a part where it says everything disappearing, which ends with the word like kieru, and then it stops, and then a big scream comes in with again like hard drum beats, using the drums to perfectly encapsulate the like rage and defiance in the lyrics.
Yeah.
In this case, it's the singer then being like, why can't I escape into that fantasy? I should be able to, you know, it's what I need, which I think is interesting. You know, using fiction to escape, finding solace in that sort of fantasy world. But that also weirdly kind of ties to being a Vocaloid producer.
Yeah!
In sort of, it's like Waka's perspective from Unhappy Refrain, or like right before that, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true, but the fact that this was the first song he did feels pretty poignant about that.
Yeah.
Like, this is a statement of intent. Also, this one's also terminally climactic.
Nice.
With the screaming and all that coming at the very end as like its own part of the song. Next song is Zureteku, which is also terminally climactic, and the intro of it reminds me of Screwbots. Because it has, like, machine sounds.
Nice.
Like, pistons and stuff. It's great. This one's kind of interesting, because it has a horror element to it. But for, I think, a very specific purpose that's not specifically to be a horror story. It, like, opens with something about, like, the body vanished.
That's the intro to my favorite two-sentence horror. But the body vanished. Oh shit, said the guy in charge of making sure bodies stay put.
I would say brevity is the soul of wit, but if this is bad two sentence
yeah,
horror,
exactly.
So like, but like the creature, yeah, anyways,
yeah.
That's neither here nor there. So the line Zureteku literally means like out of step. The lyrics seem to be about someone who is viewing their partner who seems to have changed. They're now out of step or like stumbling. To the point where they could be, like, a doppelganger, or a monster in disguise. Or just a murderer with a secret. The body disappearing is contrasted with this strange version of the singer's partner. And I think it's meant to sound like a horror story, bring to mind, like, the close, what's it called, relationship horror about, you know, having a monster for a partner, your partner turning into a doppelganger.
Yeah.
Millions say their partner doesn't know the real them, an anonymous poll claims.
Yes.
I don't know about you, but I'm checking my partner's belongings for fake passports. I've already reported mine to the authorities.
I would like to say this song is very unrealistic, because if I found out my partner was secretly a monster, I'd be like, hell yeah! Anyway.
Yeah. Not much to say about this one. But I have a lot to say about the next one, World's End Dance Hall, which was another of the super popular ones, maybe more so in the West than in the East. Content warning.
Yay!
Content warning for the next sort of, I would say, 5 minutes or so, we're going to be mentioning self-harm and suicide.
Yep. That's okay. A not uncommon theme from my understanding.
Yeah, a lot of Vocaloid's songs do involve that, especially because, like, horror and tragedy and almost to an edgy degree misery were very popular as themes. And I think Will Waka was partially responsible for popularizing that.
Yeah, yeah.
World's End Dance Hall is another one that had a pretty popular music video. This one's also interesting because it's Miku and Luca.
Yes. It's not the only Miku and Luca one, actually, from my understanding.
But this one is very important that it's a duet because it is about lovers doing a lover's suicide.
Ah, the Romeo and Juliet style.
Sort of. It's more like Fry and Leela.
Okay.
So the song is about the singer and their lover dancing on a rooftop. And eventually the lyrics imply that they dance and fall to their death, either jumping off the edge or stumbling off in a sort of haphazard dance. Clearly, that's their end goal here. They have been degraded and mocked and shunned by their peers. They feel that they are left alone in their own corner of the world that is ending. The World's End Dance Hall is this rooftop, and they're going to end the world there. It's pretty well conveyed, too. I think like that is a pretty reasonable reading from the lyrics.
Yeah.
I really like sort of the poetry, the romanticism of one last dance at the end of the world. If you were to take it literally, it would be beautiful.
Yes.
That there's like, everything's ending, let's have this one last moment of tender togetherness, this intimacy. Also, I like how the rhythm of the chorus has, like, the lyrics feel like they're dancing. They kind of swing down and up when they do like hop and step. They like go down in pitch through like a legato almost, and then go back up and then down and up. And it has like a meter to it that feels like it's spinning around. And I think that's really cool. There's also a distortion guitar that kind of echoes in at the start, and near the end it echoes back out, which I think is sort of like flatlining.
Yeah, yeah.
The image for this is very important. Oh, I forgot to mention the image for Two-Face Lovers also is important. But the image for this one is two squares with a square inside of them side by side with inverted colors like a yin-yang motif.
Yeah.
It's... They look like doors. I think they might literally have little dots on them to be door handles.
They do. They do. It's genuinely very like Stanley Parable.
Yeah.
Not to, you know, guy who's only ever seen Stanley Parable when he sees two doors, but...
It's another super iconic image for sort of the song. And I like it because you could represent that as being like the doors to the top of the building. Or it could be that they're just isolated, that they've shut themselves in.
Yeah.
This is their world's end. Here's sort of a weird one. Going back to Theory Bait, another one I have a bone to pick. There was a fan theory that was pretty popular that the lover was like a headmate or an imaginary friend, or dare I say a tulpa. And I don't really get how people came up with that, but I remember that being a very common sentiment, and I don't get it.
Huh. That feels more like someone on the internet learned a new word.
Yeah, it feels to me like it wasn't already edgy enough, and they wanted it to have more of a surprise. Like, it's like the people who are conspiracy theorists that think that Epstein is still alive.
Yeah.
Because the other conspiracy theory is too real sounding.
Yeah.
Like, it's too obvious that there is this tragic twist to this song, so we need to come up with a different one.
That's not even like Ash is secretly in a coma. That's like if it was confirmed that Ash was in a coma, and then somebody was like, no, actually, it all did happen, and this was him like flashing back into the past because he never had a father or whatever.
No, it's more like somebody played Jimmy in the Pulsating Mask. Shout out to Casey Osmey, by the way. I had to work that in there. And it came out with the reading of like, oh, actually, Jimmy is an adult playing with Legos. Like, where did you get that from? There's a very obvious sign pointing and flashing at the correct reading.
Yeah.
And you're ignoring it. Not that there is always one correct reading. There could be more than one. But still, it's a wrong reading.
Yeah.
Get your sources. Get your evidence. I want to see footnotes.
This sign can't stop me because I can't read.
But it's really, see, the funny thing about that is that she had to read to understand the sign, to know to say that. She only says that because she knows how to interpret the sign. Fucking but, DW.
Just quick shout out to Sesame Street for making DW a cop.
Sesame Street?
Sorry, fuck. Oh, no, I'm thinking...
Fake fan of Arthur?
I know,
Exposed?
My friend was... I was watching one of my online friends playing My Happy Neighborhood. Shout out to Mascot
You mean
Horror.
My Friendly Neighborhood?
My Friendly Neighborhood. Fuck!
Fake My Friendly Neighborhood fan. Exposed.
Fuck this. I'm gonna go watch the Man Domino catalog.
One can stop Man Domino catalog. Okay.
So,
last song, the third underrated song of the album, Prism Cube.
Cube.
Beautiful. I love this one because instead of it coming out swinging, it layers things slowly. Like, every phrase adds a new instrument or part to the song. Phrase being 8 measures or 16. It's like the length of sort of... Think of it like a paragraph in music.
Yeah.
Like, you'll hear songs often separated into blocks of song. A good example is, like, in Wake Me Up When September Ends, the drums kick in on the second phrase.
Yes.
But in this case, it does that for every instrument. Every instrument is introduced over time, while Miku is there from the start. Very good song. It's... Again, about being empty, the world losing its luster, depression as a whole. But it's interesting because the singer talks about shutting their heart away in a box, that it was like dazzling, too painful to look at. But the song is called Prism Cube, and prisms are clear.
Ah.
And not only that, when exposed to light, they give off rainbows. So it feels like there is a sort of true self that is being either hidden away intentionally or sort of... by depression, and it's hard to compare their current self struggling with depression to their like inner self.
Yeah.
This idealized version who is sparkling and rainbow fold.
I like too that kind of that ostensibly implies that like they're the same person just under different circumstance, like quite literally it is the same sort of, you know, the lyrics are about, you know, being hollow, being clear, but you know, like you said, just being subject to sunlight is what makes that, you know, what gives the color from a prism.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, it implies that, like, you know, the trouble is, the current trouble, once it passes, will give way to a beautiful, you know, a beautiful reality.
Yeah. Also worth noting is that Tsumiki no Ningyo, the one with the doll in the glass.
Yep.
Mentions in the chorus a, like, holding a transparent rainbow, and then that rainbow shattering.
Ah!
That kind of connects to the prism cube. The prism creates a rainbow, it's a transparent object, a transparent box hiding, you know, their true self. And did it shatter to release something, or did it shatter and that is, like, a full-on descent?
Yeah.
Further.
I feel like, to throw in a little bit of my own analysis, the transparent rainbow from the doll is like a veneer. It's a, you know, it's a construction that shatters. But the transparent, like the prism cube, the transparent on the inside, like what shines through that is light, you know.
Yeah.
And so like the transparent rainbow from there is literally something that cannot shatter. And so, like, I feel like it's, you know, you could read an amount of positivity into it of, like, it is a song that is about depression, but one that hides a positive message.
Mm-hmm. Also, it could be that, like, the transparent rainbow is a prism that's not being held to light, thus it doesn't have a visible rainbow.
Yes.
And so, if the prism cube is being, you know, locked away inside yourself, it might not be exposed to light. Also worth noting is that the glass in Tsumiki no Ningyo is all external. Like, it's glass slippers and stuff like that. Whereas the glass in prism cube is, assuming the prism is the box shut inside themselves, is internal.
Yes.
It's a part of themselves that is fragile, but they are not exposing to danger. It's a good song. I think it's interesting to me how the album, it was not all released as like a concept. It had a lot of singles that were released as just songs released by a producer that were later collected into the album with other tracks, you know, peppered throughout. There was even like a prior version of this, more of an EP than an LP, called I believe it was just called the Monochrome album.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Because that's sort of Wawaka's style. But, like, even then, it feels like he's constructed a narrative that flows throughout the album that is both about separate things and about being a Vocaloid producer. And, like, so many songs feel so personal despite being sung through Hatsune Miku.
Yeah.
We talked about how Miku is often conflated to be sort of her own character who made the songs. And I think it could be devastating to make a song so personal, like in the Gray Zone, and have it not be really connected to you as a person.
Yeah.
And I think that emotion comes through in something like Unhappy Refrain. But at the same time, there's other songs on this album that are just like fully, it feels like opening up about you and your identity through the music, which is what this last song kind of makes me feel like, Prism Cube.
It's always worth remembering in the back of your mind that Hatsune Miku, like Vocaloids in general, they are tools which people use to express themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And like sometimes that expression, you know, comes in the form of like playing to this character of Miku, like of who Miku is. But a lot of the time it also comes from like using a sound bank, using the voice of Miku to tell exceedingly personal stories.
Yeah. In many ways, a Vocaloid is an instrument as much as drums or guitar. And like I've said, there's songs that sound like they're by Wawaka about himself versus songs told from a character's perspective. And I try to put a disclaimer on that, because a lot of these could simply be all from Wawaka's perspective, and some of them could be filtered through Miku as sort of a character to allude to feelings, but maybe not directly be feelings. But I think either way, like, it makes these songs really resonating and powerful.
Yeah.
And I super vibe with them, both even without knowing the lyrics, but especially with knowing the lyrics.
Yes.
It's great. It's beautiful. Also listen to Hitorie. I want to mention a bit about Wawaka's legacy.
Yes.
So I think Wawaka really popularized the melancholic, tragic era of Vocaloids. Like, I think, you know, before this, you had a lot of songs that viewed Miku as a character, but you had a lot that were like upbeat or kind of idiosyncratic, like Popipo.
Yeah, it's as an idol inspired character, it makes sense that like a lot of the songs would be very, you know, upbeat, happy, like you said, Popipo. And so,
yeah, and then you have other more directly idol songs like Melt by Ryo or World Is Mine, also by Ryo.
Nice.
By the way, Ryo made a bunch of classics, great producer, which really lean into, these are like songs that an idol would say or sing normally. These are like, yeah, very, very feminine songs told from the feminine perspective. But like, I feel like before Wawaka, there wasn't as much about like loss and death and sort of really mature topics. I'd have to look at when Hachi started making music, because Hachi is sort of a contemporary of Wawaka, who was, by their words, really inspired by Wawaka. So I'm assuming they came around on the scene and started making music after Wawaka did.
Yeah.
Hachi did things like Donut Hole and Matryoshka, and Hachi has these similar very like dark themes throughout their songs.
It could be a case of either like, you know, convergent evolution, but or inspiration. But like Wawaka's legacy is definitely something that lives on through Hachi, is undeniably kind of a,
yeah,
or
and,
like
in Hitorie.
And Hitorie.
I think Wawaka also, like, the rhythm piano became a pretty big thing after Hachi. I mean, after Wawaka. It's in a few other songs. It was more of his thing. But like his style of almost drum and bass, almost hardcore rock was like not super popular beforehand. And I definitely know that it inspired other people. Like, I think Disappearance of Hatsune Miku, for example, feels like a response to Wawaka.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. Even with the Fast Miku. Might I say he might have popularized Fast Miku in some ways with Uramote Lovers. I think, like, though, there's just a very specific tone that he conveyed that a lot of people resonated with and then took on to sort of bring to themselves. Jin actually has a lot of Wawaka elements, Kagero Day is one of Jin's more popular songs. Really feels Wawaka inspired with like the heavy drums, maxed out with the mastery, you know, really high volume, tragic sort of backstory going on.
I mean, yeah, that's like, that's another entire conversation is like, how did Vocaloid kind of impact the J-rock scene?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of popular J-rock artists nowadays started as Vocaloid artists.
Yeah.
Like, I believe Eve started as a Vocaloid artist. I think Yoasobi did, and they literally just made one of the most popular songs of the year internationally.
Nice.
I think Yama started as Vocaloid, but don't quote me on that. But yeah, and obviously a lot of the artists and sort of that stuff, they went hand in hand. Vocaloid was an internet scene, but it affected the popular music, and then that affected Vocaloid again.
Yeah.
And nowadays it's very intertwined. Like, for example, another famous producer that I didn't mention was Deco27, who did music that was not Vocaloid related before doing Vocaloid music, and then later did Vocaloid music, and then still does other music as well. They're like, they just make music, and they view Vocaloid more of like a tool you can use.
Yeah.
They had a lot of really popular Gumi songs. They did Cowardly Mont Blanc, Two Breaths Walking, Mosaic Roll. And I think Deco27 is also interesting because by being such a prominent artist outside of Vocaloid, they were really well recognized. Like, I knew who Deco27 was before I knew who Wawaka was.
Yeah.
Because Deco27's name was on things. But no, going back to Wawaka, like that part, I think the tone in the mood and the identity of what it meant to be Vocaloid music was greatly impacted by his work. Also, man, it's fucking bangers after bangers.
Yeah.
Like, it can't be understated how good these songs are.
Speaking of which, part of the run-up to this, part of my homework to this, was listening to a lot of classics.
I made a Vocaloid core playlist on YouTube.
Yes.
Relatively organized by release date, sort of era, at least.
Yeah, heavily relatively.
Yeah.
And, like, just to shout out a couple of specific bangers. Disappearance, like you said, already fucking great. Matryoshka is a classic for a fucking reason. Triple Baka is one that I've been a fan of even since long before
I didn't
this.
Put that into the playlist because it has Utaoo, which are not Vocaloids.
Yes.
Utaoo is like a freeware voice synthesizer software where you can make your own voice banks. People nowadays do it with like samples from SpongeBob and Squidward and Naruto and... Look up, please look up the Cursed Utaoo concert.
Yes!
It's one of the best things to come out of the internet, and it's like the epitome of like the uber character mentality that we talked about.
Yeah, 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 no, those are great. And like Utaoo as well are like also generally pretty good. There's at least two, I think, that are fairly popular.
Tato's the one that matters.
Yes.
She's in Triple Baka. She has the Fukureta, I think is what it's called.
Yes.
You've seen it before. Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, man. There's a really fucked up one about Lin. Or no, it's Ren. No, it's Ren. There's a fucked up one about Ren that made it into Project Diva that you don't have to look up.
Are you talking about Rinchan Now?
Yes,
Rinchan
that one.
Now. Rinchan Now.
Rinchan Now. Yeah.
Let me say a few. I want to shout out Tale of 6 Billion Years in a Night, or 6 Trillion Years in a Night. That's an ES song and it's very good. I want to shout out Telecaster B-Boy, Roki. Those are both phenomenal. Already mentioned those a bunch.
We said it a bunch of times. Popipo.
Yeah, Popipo is a classic.
Fucking love it.
Chudududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududududud Vocaloid. It has a really interesting rhythm, but I fucking love it, and Kuragi-P is great. Please look up Dance Robot Dance if you're gonna look up one from Nayutalia.
I was literally about to say, like, what was, like, the big one? Dance Robot Dance.
Yeah.
Many never had a chance.
Holy, oh my god, I'm writing that down.
Please check out, the next hit mashup from Photon Punch.
I also want to mention something. So many people don't understand this. Nyan Cat is a Hatsune Miku song.
It fucking,
it
what?
Started as nya-nya-nya-nya-nya-nya, NYA, repeated over and over again.
Yeah.
The original video for it was not Nyan Cat. It was like Miku with cat ears doing a little dance and going nya-nya-nya-nya. Yeah, that's Miku.
Oh my god. That is... Wow, yeah, that's deep internet lore.
Also, remote control is the best one with both Kagamine twins. Is a great sort of use of them going back and forth. Shout us to Double Lariat, which has a great video. Very sad. Trying to think of like any other standout I'm forgetting. I don't know. I got back into Vocaloid because I started playing Groove Coaster. And like it's fun to see all these rhythm games have like classic Vocaloid songs from when I was a kid. Two-Face Lovers and Rolling Girl are especially very popular from Wawaka's sort of discography. And it's really nice to see.
So my cut here that I'm going to throw in is there was a video that had a banger song, but I can't remember the song because I can't remember the video. Because it was a Project Diva song where the whole bit was that like it went through all the different outfits that Hatsune Miku could put on. A lot of them were different Sega references. By the way, Hatsune Miku has a Ryu number of like 3, I think, because it's Ulala. It's Miku to Ulala, Ulala to Sonic, Sonic to Ryu. Because there was a crossover thing. It was a Space Channel 5 VR thing with Hatsune Miku. So she has been in a video game.
I'm trying to remember if she is in Dengeki Bunko Fighting Climax. I don't think she is. I feel like she has to have a shorter Ryu number than that,
the
thing.
She might. Minimum 3 at least, because, like, again, her Ulala, Ulala, Sonic, Sonic, Ryu.
Hold on, does Groove Coaster have it? Groove Coaster has Neku, but he's, like, not in jack shit. Miku to Neku, Neku to Sora, Sora to Ryu, that's the same amount. Anyways.
So okay. we're gonna put this all on a big...
This is the bonus features.
Yeah.
My deep cut, so I mentioned the Kumikyoku Niku Niku Doga medley. This is a whole episode I want to do eventually, but so there's like 4 or 5 medleys made by Shimo, who popularized the whole goddamn thing. You may have heard Kumikyoku no Niku Niku Doga from the Automatic Mario video that got huge on YouTube.
Yes.
Which was of that medley.
Which is fucking old YouTube, too.
Kumikyoku has 0 Vocaloid songs, and I believe Monogatari.wave, the second Shimo medley, also has 0 or 1 Vocaloid song. Ryuseigun has 2, 3 if you count Yavon Polka, or Yavon Polka.
Which is kind of...
Kind of, but not really. It's known for having a Miku cover of it, but that's not the original. The leak spin one with Orihime from Bleach uses the original, whereas in Japan they had the Miku one, which has Miku, and it's Miku. But it does have Miku Miku Nishita Ageru and Melt, I believe. Nanairo no Niku Niku Doga, the 4th one by Shimo, has like 7 or 8 Vocaloid songs in the main part, not counting the rapid fire blitz at the end as it goes through like a ton of songs in quick succession.
Yeah, the what a catch Donnie ending.
Yeah, pretty much. That's in like all of them.
Yeah.
Usually accompanied by Let's Go on Myohi, which was just really popular in the medleys. But Nanairo was like, by that point, Vocaloid was big, and you can tell.
Yeah.
I just thought that was interesting. I thought for sure there was at least 1 Miku or Vocaloid song in general in Kumikyoku, but nope. Nada.
0.
But there are like 3 Toho songs in there. But that's a tale for another day. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much for listening.
You can find us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a comment, give us a review. Let us know how we're doing.
Tell us what song we need to cover.
Yeah, tell us what Vocaloid song we need to do our own vocal cover of. I don't want to do some of the bad ones. I'll let you figure out which ones those are.
You'll know it's a bad one when you suggest it and we go, no.
That's bad.
Yeah. That's good. That's bad.
Let us know what you want to see us cover in the future as far as episodes go, and if there's anything you think we'd like, hit us up and we can maybe check that out. You can follow us on Twitter/X, whatever it ends up being called next year.
We're going to be calling it Twitter.
Yeah.
I think we're going to be calling it Twitter till the day we die, much like how I still call Bayer Monsanto. Or
they're not called Monsanto. Oh wait, they did merge.
Yeah, they got merged, and they're still Monsanto, but they're technically Bayer.
They're still Monsanto at heart, but that's for another episode.
Yeah.
But you can follow us on Twitter at NetSurferPro, where we post little teasers on upcoming episodes. I forgot to do the one for this episode, but maybe it'll be up by the time we get this up.
Oh shit!
But we're gonna have a big theme month planned.
Yes.
For spooky month.
Yes.
And I'm literally just going to put one emoji, and I hope you can figure out what it means.
Yeah.
So that's coming up. That's exciting. You can also follow me on Twitter at Twackaroo, where I post my hot takes, my cold takes, medium takes, a lot of pinball high scores, and also updates on projects I'm working on. I'll probably link the aforementioned unlisted Vocaloid core playlist if you're interested through there. And also, I tend to link my stream where I go live on twitch.tv/twack, twitch.tv/twak. I stream every other weekday almost sometimes. It's been a little hard lately, but I play a lot of roguelites, play a lot of single player games.
Been playing a lot of pinball currently.
Playing a lot of pinball, so many pinball streams. And I also have been doing Humongous Mondays, where every Monday I play through a different kids' point-and-click adventure game from Humongous Entertainment. And some of them have been really interesting to go back to.
Yeah.
You know, this is like Putt-Putt, Pajama Sam, Freddy Fish, Spy Fox. Those are the four ones. And it's a lot of nostalgia, a lot of fun. Very, very enjoyable. I also have been playing through Cruelty Squad, which I need to fish in it and sell the fish on the market in order to buy a house in the game, and then I can continue streaming it.
Nice.
And I'm probably going to start Pikmin 4 soon, or I've already started Pikmin 4. So, yeah, come check that out. It's a good time, a lot of good discussion, and, yeah, just check that out. Nice. Also, you can find a link to my YouTube channel through there where I post the VOD. So if you want to see an old stream of mine, look up Twack's VODs and Ends on YouTube.
Good name.
Thank you.
Speaking of good names, you can find me on Twitter and on TikTok at Galen Wilson. That's at GALENWLS0N.
That's a good name.
I post my hot takes, and I've been very fighty on Twitter, but maybe go to my TikTok instead. I have a little bit better content there, I would say. Twitter, you're going to get some bangers like Mark Zuckerberg, Daniel Uski. As for my YouTube channel, you can find me on The Only Galen on YouTube, where I have been making plans. I have actually been writing videos, but, you know, why do that when you can find me on Twitch at Machine Gun Vampire, where I'll never stream.
Yep, it's true. He just wanted to have, like, a long list of like sign-offs and plugs here, because I have it, and we try to view ourselves as equals in terms of this podcast.
Yeah, which is decidedly untrue, and you shouldn't do it at all. You, the listener. I'm not saying you, Matthew Marissa, although yeah. Honestly, you, Matthew Marissa, probably should view this as more of like a 75%, 25% sort of deal.
Hey, you should think higher of yourself.
Oh, okay, sorry, an 80%, 20% kind of deal.
that's great. Well, I hope you enjoyed this look into a classic part of the internet. And Harry, is there anything you want to say? Shit, hold on. Cut his mic.
No,
cut his mic.
No,
cut his mic.
We do not endorse...